nature versus nurture on parenting. Nature matters a lot. The overall effect of the environment is pretty small. Maybe one parenting decision, the most important, and that's where they raise their kids. Romance, it's a competitive market, and you're competing with 95% of people for mates. It turned out that the predictive power was surprisingly low in predicting romantic happiness. A good short-term friend tells you what you want to hear, but a good long-term friend tells you uncomfortable truths.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. Are you ready? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Okay, friends, you are in for a treat with today's episode. It is a super fun one. I love when I get to do episodes that are not all about diet and health and wellness and physical things like that, but instead about hacking your life. Seth Stevens, David Owitz's work is honestly just fascinating. I learned so much reading his book, and we dive so deep into many topics in today's episode, including things like racism in dating, what actually makes us happy, the role of quantified self data, whether or not you can fool yourself, how physical appearance affects success, whether or not sports performance is genetic, how parenting choices affect children, over versus underestimated values in people for dating, whether or not alcohol actually makes you happy, you may be surprised, and so much more. I cannot wait to hear what you guys think. Let me know what you think in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Food plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram. Also find the Friday announcement post there. And again, comment to enter to win something that I love. There will be a full transcript in the show notes, as well as links to everything that we talk about. That will be at melanieavalon.com/don't trust your gut. If you are enjoying the show, the one way you can truly, truly support it is to subscribe and or write a brief review in Apple Podcasts. It helps so much more than most people realize. So thank you so much in advance for that. Hi, friends. Did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/melanieavalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com. melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers, use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus, you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. All right, without further ado, please enjoy this wonderful conversation with Seth Stevens Davidowitz. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation that I am about to have. So the backstory on today's conversation, if you listened to the interview that I did with John Levy for his book, You're Invited, that was a really fun and fascinating interview because it went into a lot of topics, not so much health related, but more social related and why we do the things we do and how we're connected to people. And John connected me, appropriately enough, to his friend Seth Stevens Davidowitz, who is a New York Times bestseller. I was familiar with his first book, which was called Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. But Seth had a newer book coming out called Don't Trust Your Gut, Using Data. I can never decide if it's data or data, but using data to get what you really want in life. And just seeing the title, I was immediately very excited about the concept. So obviously it was immediate yes. And then I read the book and this, because I read a lot of books for this show, and this was one of those books where I just so thoroughly enjoyed the experience of reading it. Like literally, it's just a collection of fascinating information about why we do what we do and ultimately how we can potentially get what we want in everything in life. So happiness, romance, our careers, sports, it's fascinating. There's so much information. I have so many questions. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this conversation. So Seth, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Melanie.
So to start things off, well, we were talking right before this about how you are, you know, connected to a lot of different social circles. I'm super curious your backstory. So like growing up, when did you become interested in data and information and figuring out like why people do what they do and what they're going to do? How did that happen?
My life has been totally, as far as I can tell, just like a lot of random steps that I don't totally understand. I majored in philosophy. philosophy in college, like, which I think is only loosely, very, very loosely connected to what I now do. As I talk about my book, I wanted to be a professional athlete when I was a kid. That was like all I really wanted, but I had basically no athletic talent. So, but I think I've always been interested in people. And yeah, I've always been interested in numbers and math, and I've always been interested in writing. So kind of when I did my first book, Everybody Lies, kind of all of it came together, these interests I had, and then same with Don't Trust Your Gut. So I don't know. It's felt very random. My career, people always ask me for advice, and I kind of don't know what to tell people. Because, well, first, I wrote a whole book of advice, so I tell them to just read the book. But also, I feel like my life is not, it's an anecdote, not data. And for all I know, like all the things I did were, you know, I just got probably lucky a few times. So I don't know.
So you just touched on a lot of keywords that I actually had questions about. So that's perfect. Like anecdotes, data, random, luck. I mean, they're like filtered all throughout everything that you just said. So I have this huge haunting question, just using data and math to predict everything. Can it predict everything? What can it not predict? And then a broader question, which actually might be a philosophical, so we can just tie that in too. If it does predict things, why? Is there like a universal thing to all of humans that makes these things manifest predictably, or is every single thing unique to that topic for why it can be predictable?
Yeah, well, so the answer to your first question is no, data can't predict everything. But I think it's interesting and useful the ways in which data fails and the places in which data fails. So I talk in the book about this study by Samantha Joel and a bunch of other scientists trying to predict romantic happiness. And they had this amazing data set. They had more than 11,000 couples, and they were trying to predict, you know, they had everything you could think to measure on them, you know, their demographics, background, education, religion, race, their values, their beliefs about parenting, their hobbies, their interests, their sexual tastes, just this huge, the holy grail of relationship data sets. And they used advanced machine learning techniques to try to predict romantic happiness. And they found that it's, and I'm like, this is amazing. This is going to answer like the question, one of the biggest questions everybody has in life. What should I look for in a partner? And if, you know, they throw this data and the machine learning models, everybody can just then, you know, when they're in a relationship, put their data in this model and the algorithm can tell them stay or go. And this is going to transform everything. And it turned out that the predictive power was surprisingly low in predicting romantic happiness, and particularly predicting changes in romantic happiness. It's very, very hard to predict whether a relationship's going to get better or worse over time, knowing everything you can possibly know about two human beings in that relationship. But I think there's something profound in the difficulty of predicting romantic happiness and changes in romantic happiness, because a lot of us think we can make these predictions. So a lot of us stay in really, really bad relationships. You know, we're unhappy now, but on paper, we should be happy. So this kind of has to work. Or we make the reverse decision. I'm happy now, but there are too many red flags. This is too weird. We're too different. This isn't the stuff of a long-term serious relationship. And I think the lack of predictive power in relationships tells us that we're making a mistake. Basically, the only thing that predicts future romantic happiness is current romantic happiness. So all of us should just kind of go with how we're feeling in a relationship and not think too much about traits that we share or don't share with our partner.
Okay. So if we're applying that to like the red flags concept, would that mean that if it's a red flag that feels like a red flag, like emotionally it feels off, then you should go with that? But if it is a red flag just by like what other people would say is a red flag, then maybe you don't have to like worry about that as much.
Yeah, exactly. So an example is if I'm in a relationship and I'm really, really happy, but we have different political views and we come from very different families, or maybe we have different religious backgrounds, but I'm happy, you know, the person that my partner makes me feel good, then don't worry about what those seeming red flags, because the data says that they're not, that none of these things seem to have much predictive power down the road. Yeah. And again, and I think the even more important is the reverse situation that probably many of us either have been there or know someone who's been there, where two people just look so good on paper, but they're not really happy. And I think a lot of us stay in such relationships way too long.
Does that mean like if you go on a first date and you're not feeling it like right away, you should abandon ship?
I think that it might take, I think give it a little longer than a first date. You know, the study, usually it's people are ready in relationships for a decent amount of time. So I don't think you can use this right away necessarily on a first date. But definitely if you're in a relationship for a couple months, then you want to just pay attention to whether you're happy with that person or unhappy with that person. Don't pay attention to anything else.
So just with gathering this data, before dating apps, how would they gather this?
Yeah, so before dating apps, there were these studies kind of what predicts what makes someone attractive. And it was basically just asking people. But that gets into the point of my first book, Everybody Lies, which is that people lie when you ask them questions on sensitive topics, such as what they're attracted to. Either they're lying consciously to you or they're lying to themselves. So, you know, if you ask people in a survey, what are you looking for in a mate? You know, the number one answer will be someone nice, someone kind. Right near the bottom will be someone really attractive or someone rich. So it's a very misleading as far as telling us what people are actually looking for. And, you know, the data from dating apps is more, I think, revealing and a little dark, depressing, because people are more superficial than they sometimes say. On just about on a lot of dimensions, everything from physical attractiveness and height to race, there's a lot of prejudice in online dating that's not always talked about.
This is a huge question I have, and I don't know how to phrase it, but I've been thinking about it while reading that whole chapter. So, like, we're using the word shallow to define these characteristics that we're attracted to, but like the root of attraction, like from an evolutionary perspective, I'm assuming it goes beyond our, you know, prefrontal cortex and has to do with who might ultimately be the best mate for us. So how do we judge certain qualities as shallow or not? Like, I think on the surface, people might say, oh, physical attraction is shallow because that's just looks. But you could also see it as that's like something very, you know, evolutionarily driven, that this person might actually be a better physical compatibility match for you. And then there might be something like intelligence, and that could be, I feel like we don't say like it's shallow to, well, maybe some people do, but to go after somebody intelligent, but that is also in a way just a biomarker of social or, you know, intellectual fitness. So, well, I guess then there's character traits like kindness and compassion. Maybe it's not shallow to want that, but maybe that has an evolutionary spin. I guess, how do we judge?
I think there are a couple points that are important to keep in mind. One is that there is at least some evidence that physical attraction can change over time. I talk about a study in the book where they ask people at the beginning, they ask college students at the beginning of class, who do you find the most attractive? And everyone kind of agrees it's people who have qualities that from an evolutionary perspective may suggest, you know, greater health, like symmetry of their faces. But then at the end of the class, they ask the same people who's the most attractive and the answers diverge because people start spending time with each other. And some of the people that, you know, initially thought, wow, they're really hot, well, you actually don't connect with them, you're going to find them less attractive. And people who you didn't think were that attractive, you spend a lot of time with them, you do connect with them, you find them more attractive. So it is important to keep in mind that physical attractiveness can grow or shrink over time. And then an open question in my mind before seeing the data was, does physical attractiveness correlate with long-term relationship satisfaction? Since that's what a lot of us are after when we're searching for a mate. There's obviously a difference if we're not looking for just a short fling, but if we're looking for a long-term mate, we want to know what traits are most predictive of long-term happiness. And it could be, if you looked at the data, that people who end up with conventionally beautiful people end up happier. Maybe they have, you know, better sex lives or better social lives. And this really is an, you know, important predictor of long-term happiness. But if you look at the data, it seems to have just about no correlation with long-term romantic satisfaction. You know, people who end up with, I guess, conventionally the most attractive people don't report that they're happier in the relationship than people who ended up with less conventionally attractive people. So I think it is important to keep in mind that wherever these desires are coming from, and I agree some of it is probably evolutionarily driven, you know, if we're trying to maximize our long-term romantic happiness, we are being tricked to some extent by some of these qualities. So, you know, I think it's just important to keep that in mind that you're being tricked. And, you know, another thing I talk about in the book is, you know, the dating romance is a market and it's a competitive market. And, you know, if you're heterosexual and you're competing with 95% of people who share of the same gender for mates. And, you know, the fact that everybody is after that, that so many people are drawn to these qualities like conventional attractiveness, you know, height in males, certain sexy occupations, it means that these people are going to be much more difficult to get dates with, let alone to be in a relationship with. So, you know, I think a lot of people who are perpetually single are trying and failing to date beautiful people. That's one of my diagnoses. But, you know, I give people these advice. I told some of my friends, I'm like, you know, yeah, the key to dating is, you know, care less about beauty and hotness. And all of them are like, yeah, I'm not listening to you. I don't care. So this is, you know, hard advice to follow. And, you know, if I'm being honest in my own dating life, to be fair, I met my girlfriend, long-term partner, before I had dove into this research. And I was basically attracted, you know, immediately drawn to her because I thought she was really hot. So whether people actually follow this advice or not, I think it is important to keep in mind that we're all being tricked a little bit in that the qualities that make us most likely to swipe right are not necessarily the qualities that lead to long-term happiness.
It's funny to hear you say that because I was wondering how the advice would land on people because, you know, you did have the sections about maybe you would have more success with long-term happiness and even just making a match if you go for these undervalued qualities in people. But then I feel like the like happy medium solution that you provided was turning it into a numbers game. Like basically if you just ask out a lot of people, then the odds go up of making a match with somebody who might fall into your bucket of what you were hoping for with the attractive label. It's so interesting. Do you know if there's data on age differences in relationships, age gaps? I'm asking for personal. I've always dated older, so I'm wondering about that.
Yeah, it's a moderate predictor. Remembering from the Samantha Joel study, which I'd have to look at it again, it wasn't like a zero predictor, like attractiveness and height. It was more of a predictor where I think a big age gaps are negative predictors of lasting relationships. But yeah, I think, you know, there also is obviously evidence that age plays a big role in desirability in online dating as well.
Younger for women and older for...
Yeah, men kind of hit their peak in their mid-40s, according to the data, and women hit their peak very, very early. But yeah, I don't know, which is, I guess, another superficial trait that people care too much about.
Like, I feel like there's like reasons behind it, like that we're not consciously aware of, just as far as, I guess, like for age, for a man, it would symbolize like security and finances. And for women, it would be reproductive ability, maybe.
Yeah, well, someone I was on a date with once said that all men think they're going to be most attractive. Like they just want to be patient, wait until they hit their 40s, because then everyone will be into them. But her hypothesis, which I haven't seen data on, but it was interesting, was that men actually, they basically have their 20s and 30s to prove themselves. And then the 40s, they either prove themselves or they prove that they couldn't do it. So there's actually more variance. So, you know, yeah, if you're 40 something and you sold, you know, 5 businesses and are worth $100 million, you're going to do really well. If you're 40 something and you haven't had a job and are addicted to drugs and play video games all day, you're going to do even worse than you did when you were 30 and at least you had some potential. So, but I think on average, men do get a little boost, you know, in their 40s. Although I think it's not necessarily, if you actually just go based on pure looks, I think men and women both are most attractive in their youth, in their 20s. So I think, you know, men also, if you look at something like men featured in pornography videos or various other studies, they're most likely to be in their early 20s as well, or mid 20s as well. So it's not like women who are swiping right on 45-year-old men are like, wow, these guys are so hot. It's more like these guys could make, I guess, reliable fathers.
You had a lot on the male jobs that women are attracted to, but I don't think there was any data on female career.
Well, because the study suggested that it doesn't matter.
That's what I thought the answer was.
So it's basically not statistically significant that, you know, women in all different jobs are equally attractive to men. So yeah, and, you know, I guess data from dating sites uncovers some uncomfortable truths that maybe some of us have suspected, but, you know, kind of are can be proven in the data. And I don't know. I kind of don't shy away from these uncomfortable truths, but some people might find them disturbing. I find them disturbing. I found the section on race very disturbing, the racial preferences that people show in dating. And
what were some of those?
Well, that African-American women and Asian males face a big penalty in online dating. Again, like, you know, when we think of racism or discrimination, you know, most of the studies and most of the political activism have focused on, you know, criminal justice system and the employment market. And those are obviously really important. But I think if anything, there's even more evidence for discrimination in the dating market. Definitely African-American women, the discrimination that they can face in online dating isn't talked about enough. And in many ways, because most of us to be in a relation, you know, most of us, one of our main goals in life is to be in a happy, committed relationship. So this prejudice, you know, a huge stain on society, I'd say.
That's a social political issue that I don't even know how you would approach it, because presumably it might be like unconscious or subconscious racial biases where they're not going with certain races. But how would you tell people to, you know, like feel attracted to something that they don't perceive that they're not attracted to, even if they don't realize it's related to racism? Like, I don't even know how you would have a conversation to change that.
There's not an obvious solution to the issue, because I think we correctly value people's right to, you know, only date someone, to date people they're most attracted to. But it's just kind of, I don't know, it's interesting and disturbing. Maybe it should be talked about more, I think, just because when I think of, you know, people talking about discrimination and racism, it's very rare that people focus on the dating market. But I think the evidence for it is overwhelming.
Did you watch Love is Blind?
I've heard about it. I didn't actually see it.
It's like trying to tackle this question. I like really don't watch reality TV show, but I don't know why. I love that series.
I was in my 20s. I was super into reality TV. I watched, I think, all the dating shows. Like, remember Eliminate? And yeah, I don't know. There was one on MTV, like Next, where you just kind of go, they went, like, went through. Yeah, people were rejected really quickly. It was, I don't know, it was weird.
I was on an episode of Millionaire Matchmaker once. That was a fun time. A takeaway I did take away from the dating section that I thought was inspiring was the role of predictions of happiness involving, like, the questions that you asked about the actual person rather than the other person. Basically that, like, the happiness might involve if you are happy or satisfied or content.
Yeah. So this study that I talked about, the 85 scientists, like, in general, they found it very, very difficult to predict romantic happiness. But if there were any variables that had predictive power, they were mostly questions about yourself and your own mental state. So, you know, if someone says I'm satisfied with life, independent of my romantic partner, or not depressed, I'm not feeling anxious, then they're more likely to say that they're happy in their relationship, significantly more likely to say they're happy in their relationship. So it kind of goes with this kind of classic advice that someone else can't make you happy until you're happy with yourself. I think there's a lot of truth to that in the data. You know, sometimes data kind of confirms these cliched pieces of wisdom that annoy me, because I'm always like, yeah, how do you know that's true? But actually, once I see the data, I'm like, yeah, it actually is true.
Hey, friends, I'm about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com. Like most of the time, do you think there's a seed of truth to them or they wouldn't have become a cliche?
Now, I would say most of the time. So one of the things that I try to do with don't trust your gut is just say what the data said, whether it was like supported conventional wisdom or opposed conventional wisdom. Because I think too many books, like they do either one or the other. They always say like, yeah, you know, follow your heart, do all these things that sound good. They read to me like Hallmark cards. And then too many books do the reverse where they're like, we're going to bust conventional wisdom and show you only things that are counterintuitive. And I really tried not to do this, to do that with this book, to just always go with the data. And, you know, I'd say probably 60 or 70% of the time, the data tells us what we probably would have guessed. And then 30 to 40% of the time, it tells us something different than what we might have guessed. So that would be kind of my estimate based on after having written this book. And the point I take from that is you basically just can't listen to normal advice because we have no idea whether the advice is true or not. Because, you know, 60 or 70% chance it's true, but 30 or 40% is not true. So you always have to go to the data either to confirm it. Oh yeah, you know, actually you only really can expect to be happy in a relationship once you're happy by yourself. Or sometimes it overrules what we might have thought in before looking at the data.
Selfishly, I would love you to write a book on the data behind like all the different diets, because there's so many dietary wars and it's so hard to see past biases and cherry picking and stuff like that.
I don't know. Don't Trust You Gut. I tried to have a chapter about all the major questions of life, but obviously it's going to be biased by my own interests. And for whatever reason, I've just never been like a dieting person. I'm an obsessive sports fan. So instead of a pretty obvious chapter on the data of dieting, I think which a lot of people would have liked more, I had a chapter on like how to achieve athletic greatness, which I think didn't really register with that many people. But I'm the author of the book and I have to keep myself engaged.
You get to decide.
Yeah, I get to decide. And a book's such a pain in the ass that you can't really spend too much time on topics you're not passionate about.
I cannot agree more. Like, even with this show, I really only, you know, bring on things I'm really excited and interested in because, yeah. Did your publisher try to, did they want you to have in a diet chapter?
No, they just want me to finish the book because I was taking so long that I think they're just like, yeah, whatever you say at this point, we need to get this thing done. This is taking way too long. But the one thing I will say, I did do a little research on dieting, although I didn't turn it into a whole chapter. And there does seem to be increasing evidence that there's tremendous variance in what diets work for different people, probably having to do with our microbiome. So, you know, we kind of think that food is either good or bad. So carbs are either good or bad. Chocolate's good or bad. Broccoli's good or bad. And my understanding is the research is moving towards an idea that what is good for one person may be bad for another person, which bad for one person may be good for another person. So there are some people who might gain weight eating bananas and other people, you know, more people probably would lose weight, you know, eating fruits and vegetables. So I think, and there are some projects that claim that you can use machine learning and AI to figure out quickly what diet works for you. I think they're not quite there yet, but I think that's where this is ultimately going to land, which is, you know, yeah, a personalized diet. And you know, a lot of people who struggle with weight, maybe there may be foods that they think are really good for them and they think they're really being healthy and that may be good for the average person, but for reasons that aren't fully understood having to do with our guts, they're actually bad for you and causing you to gain weight.
That's good to hear because that's pretty much what I've been thinking. Actually, another book I'm reading right now is literally all about that. So I'm all about individuality. Don't think there's one right diet for everybody. And I do think it's a lot of factors like gut microbiome and glycemic control, like how you react to foods. And that might even relate to the microbiome. And yeah, there's just a lot of factors. So many other topics to touch on. Just while we're still in the attraction world, you talk about an interesting experiment you did with yourself with your, you know, physical appearance and how does physical appearance affect, you know, our success in life. So what was your experience and thoughts on that?
There are all these studies that these are also disturbing in my opinion, that you can predict how far someone's going to advance in their career based on what they look like. So Alexander Todorov, University of Chicago, just shows people pictures of the candidates for elections. And he can predict with about 70% accuracy which candidate won just by asking people which one looks more competent. So again, it's sad. We like to think that we're electing, you know, the person who has the best policy ideas or the best resume or the most compassion. But it seems like frequently we're just electing people who look the part. And there are other studies that, you know, the people who look more dominant are more likely to rise high in the military. And people who are more baby-faced are more likely to get off on crimes.
That's concerning.
Yes, that's very concerning. But that's depressing, but there is something that maybe is a little more optimistic is that they've also done studies that how we look can vary a lot. So whether on all these dimensions, attractiveness, competence, trustworthiness, dominance, small changes in how we look can lead to small changes we make to, you know, our face can lead to large changes in how we're perceived. So that kind of motivated myself to do a study where I created, using this app, FaceApp, it's artificial intelligence. I create like about 100 versions of my face. So, you know, this is what I look like. So there are versions of me with, without glasses, with a beard, without a beard, with a goatee, no goatee, smiling, not smiling, gray hair, brown hair, pink hair in one of them. And then I just did it. And then I asked people, you know, how do I look on many dimensions? One of the main ones was competence. And it turns out there are big differences in how I'm perceived. And basically I look best, I found out, when I have glasses and a beard. People just take me a lot more seriously, which I hadn't known before looking at the data and was pretty enlightening. And now I basically always have glasses and a beard.
Oh, you did? You kept it?
Yeah, I keep the beard and keep the glasses based on the market research on myself. And I think people could do, I took it to the nerdiest, as I usually do. I did the nerdiest possible version of this study, But people can do kind of a lazier version of it where you just download FaceApp or a similar app and create different versions of yourself and at least ask a bunch of people which looks best. So you may stumble on a look that you've never even considered that it turns out looks really good on you, right? So like, you know, let's say you've never grown your hair long and FaceApp, you can just say, what do I look like with long hair? And you show it to people and they're like, wow, that looks amazing. Then you might consider growing your hair out just based on the data.
When did you do that experiment?
Yeah, it was probably about a year ago. And I've definitely had a beard and glasses since. So sometimes I forget to put on my glasses. And then someone like who read my book is like, where are your glasses? You lied to us.
So have you practically, and this actually relates to a larger question I can ask from it. The smaller question is, have you practically noticed a difference in, you know, maintaining this look? And then the bigger question from that is implementing these changes based on data. Like, I just feel like we are so in our own head and we have our own cognitive biases and our own perception of things. How can we actually tell, or does it even matter if like the things we are doing are affecting what we're doing based on data?
Yeah, it's a complicated question for sure. I don't know. I always give a lot of keynote addresses. And I always like end with the joke that people, if you think I look really competent, it's because I'm wearing glasses and a beard and you're all lab rats in my life experiment. But I haven't asked people afterwards or done a controlled experiment to see, you know, how competent they view me with and without my glasses and my beard. But I think, you know, collecting data and actually listening to the data, I mean, I didn't get too into the quantified self movement in the book. You know, I was going to go to a conference on it. And then COVID hit. And I wanted to have a chapter on the quantified self movement, which is people taking this really, really seriously of measuring their sleep very closely and their, you know, blood and their cardiovascular health and glucose levels and trying to really understand how their bodies work and make adjustments based on that. I think there is a danger in that approach is that, you know, as Richard Feynman, the physicist, says, the easiest person to fool is yourself. So there definitely is, you know, a danger in doing a study on your own. You know, one of the great things about a doctor is that they're less connected. They're not connected to the participant necessarily. And, you know, they don't allow doctors to treat their own kids usually because they care too much and they, you know, might give a biased analysis based on that. So that would be a criticism, a concern I'd have about the quantified self movement is it's so easy. You know, anyone who's been or done a lot of data science knows how easy it is to trick yourself and be biased. And it's that much more easy. It's that much easier to trick yourself when you care so much about the results, you know, when it's about your own health, your own happiness, your own mood. So, you know, that is definitely a big concern.
I wonder if it's more valid to go by how other people perceive you. Like if you could, rather than polling yourself about how you feel about the changes, if you had a poll of how everybody else sees you from the changes.
I think that's right. I think that's one of the great things about friendships and relationships is that sometimes they can give you insights into yourself that other people don't give you. Although, you know, one of the people aren't always so honest and there are some things we don't want to hear. So, you know, I think I was talking recently, someone said that there's a difference between a good short-term friend and a good long-term friend. A good short-term friend tells you what you want to hear and makes you feel good in the moment. But a good long-term friend sometimes tells you uncomfortable truths about yourself that, you know, might make you angry and you go home and you say, why the hell did Alex just say that I'm picking Alex randomly, and he's not a real person. Okay, he is a real person, but like, you know, you're furious. You're like, why did that asshole tell me that? That was so mean. That was whatever. But then it kind of gets into you, and you make a couple changes, and you notice a few years later, you're like, thank God that person told me that, because I was making these huge errors in judgment. Nobody else wanted to tell me these uncomfortable truths.
That's really interesting, and especially because I feel like for a lot of people, it might require time in the relationship for them to reach a point where they acquire that trait of telling them? Because in the beginning, I think in order to like groom a friendship, or like there's a fear that you will lose a friend if you tell them the truth, especially if it's like a new friend. It's like something you have to like grow into.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend, you know, your first meeting with a friend or a first date being like, oh, you know, you look terrible, with that dress looks awful on you, or, you know, but a couple of years down the road, could you say, you know, you could dress a little better. You could, you know, I first wrote my book and I started getting some attention, and I was on YouTube, you know, podcasts, and it's on YouTube. And I religiously read all my YouTube comments, and people are like, that's the last thing you should do, because people on YouTube are so mean. But I actually found it very useful for the very reason we're discussing, which is at least they're honest. And people are telling me things that I otherwise didn't know. So they'll say things like, you know, your teeth are yellow. Nobody tells you that in real life because they don't want to be mean. But having gotten that feedback, I got whitening strips. You know, but things like this are so useful, but nobody wants to be the one to tell you, right?
That's a really good reframe. That's really interesting. Like maybe the way to get these truths about yourself, especially with social media, is to let it filter in that way.
I mean, some of it's just useless. It's like people are just mean, and you know, they tell you things that aren't really helpful, but you know, occasionally they'll tell you too much, or you say you know too much, or your teeth are yellow. That is useful information, because it's probably affecting how you're, you know, coming across.
Well, going back to something you touched on, so you do love sports a lot. I hadn't read the book, but I was familiar. I'd heard an interview. Is it David Epstein, the sports gene?
Yeah, sports.
I heard him on Peter Thiel and thought that was really fascinating. Yeah, so the big question, so when it comes to sports, is it mostly genetic?
Yeah. So it's David Epstein has this book on the sports gene about how genetic sports are. And it's another, you know, uncomfortable truth about the world, because we like to think that if you're, you know, passionate, hardworking, you know, you care enough, you can, you know, do anything. That's what we like telling kids. And David Epstein's like, no, actually, there are particular genes that make you run fast and make you a good baseball player. There are all these things, like a baseball player. Baseball players have better than 20/20 vision, almost all baseball players. Like, it's kind of this secret gift. You know, you're kind of like, well, why is that player so much better at hitting than, you know, than somebody else? And it turns out they were just gifted extraordinarily eyesight. And, you know, David Epstein talks about the body types that are good for different sports. So swimmers tend to have really long torsos and short legs, like Michael Phelps, very useful for swimming. And it's kind of depressing, the book, but I realized there's actually differences in different sports and how genetic they are. I actually figured a way to test this, which is basically how many identical twins rise to the top of a sport. Because identical twins, of course, share 100% of the genetic material. So if a sport is really, really genetic, then there will just be all kinds of tons of pairs of identical twins at the top. So basketball is an example of that, where there have just been so many more identical twins in basketball than other sports. And that's because basketball is based a ton on height, which is one of the most genetic traits there is. So each inch of height doubles someone's chances of becoming a professional basketball player. So basketball's, you know, just flooded with identical twins. But then there are some sports that don't have a lot of identical twins. So equestrian riding, diving, alpine skiing, a few sports like that, and that suggests that genetics play a lesser role. So, you know, those sports may be better bets if you aren't genetically gifted. So, you know, the best equestrian rider in the world may just be someone who's obsessed with horses from a very young age and devotes themselves to the craft. Whereas the best basketball player in the world or the best track and field runner in the world is someone who, yeah, devoted a lot of time to the craft, but also had to be given these extraordinary genetic gifts, which are so important in those sports.
Hey, friends.
Did you know there is an ancient botanical that modern research shows performs on a level comparable to metformin when it comes to supporting healthy blood sugar levels? And not only that, this compound also supports the gut microbiome, healthy cholesterol levels, and even stimulates the AMPK pathway in the body to support cellular cleanup and longevity. You might have heard about AMPK. We talk about it a lot in the context of fasting, which also stimulates it. I am talking about berberine. I take berberine every single day of my life, and I see massive differences on my CGM, my continuous glucose monitor, when I use it. I take it to support my fast and before meals to reduce blood sugar levels. It is a powerhouse of a compound. And like I said, people are prescribed the pharmaceutical metformin to control their blood sugar levels when they could be taking this completely natural compound that has been used for thousands of years in both ancient traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine. I wanted to make the best berberine on the market, so that's why I created AvalonX Berberine 500. We did so much testing to find the most potent, pure, and clean form available. There's no problematic fillers, no common allergens, just pure, vegan, lab-tested berberine extracted from traditional sources. Friends, I am not kidding the difference I see on my blood sugar levels with this berberine. We're talking no post-meal spikes when I eat all that fruit and lower fasting blood sugar levels. It also reduced my HbA1c and my cholesterol levels. You can get it at avalonx.us. And the coupon code IFPODCAST will get you 10% off. You can also get a one-time 20% off coupon code when you text AvalonX to 877-861-8318. That's AvalonX to 877-861-8318. And you can get a 15% off coupon code by signing up for email updates. For that, just go to avalonx.us/email list. Again, friends, this is one of the most powerful compounds you can add into your health and wellness routine. Healthy blood sugar control, even if you're not pre-diabetic or diabetic, is so important, and berberine helps support that. It is the ultimate compound for blood sugar control, cholesterol, your gut microbiome, and longevity. Get it at avalonx.us with the coupon code IFPODCAST.
How do you determine if the data is actually powered to find the answer? Because like presumably, I mean, I don't know how many equestrian riders there are, but I imagine there's a lot less than basketball players. Like, how do you know if you have enough data points?
If I had like, if I wrote as an academic paper, I would have had confidence intervals and more statistical analysis. But, you know, writing it as a popular book, I didn't want to bog people down. But, you know, you do test to basically say, is there a statistically significant difference? And there definitely is. It turns out one of the reasons I focused on sports, people are like, you know, you could do this analysis for other arenas of life as well. But I focused on sports because there have been so many athletes, in part because of the Olympics, you know, which happens every 4 years, and has the, you know, tons of athletes from around the world, that the sample sizes get pretty large. Where if I tried to study, you know, the genetic component to being a billionaire or being president or even being senator, sample sizes would have been too small to really do the analysis. So that's another one of the reasons I focus on sports, is because I'm obsessed with sports. And another reason is because the sample sizes are big enough to get statistical power.
Sports have never been a thing I wanted to do at all. So I've always thought, well, I haven't like actively thought about this a lot, but if I were to think about it, I probably would think, oh yeah, it's genetic. I wonder if, going back to like the cognitive biases, I wonder if when you do want to do it, if that's when it seems less genetic, because you feel like if you just practice enough, you could do it. Like, I wonder what the role of having a passion is for making something seem more genetic or not. Because like you wanted to, did you want to do baseball?
Yeah. I always say I want to do baseball, but I would have settled for being a professional basketball player as well. You know, I loved all sports. So I would have, you know, would have taken pretty much anything. But baseball was my biggest love as a kid. And yeah, I feel like whether you think something is doable, you know, partly maybe it's connected to how passionate you are about it. But I think it's also just connected to personality and, you know, talk about things like fixed mindset and growth mindset. So some people feel like their skill set is set in stone, and you know, if they're not good at something at the age of 10, they're not going to be good at it at all. And other people have more of a growth mindset and think, I'm not good at this yet. Give me time and I'll learn to get good at it. And that seems to be a predictor of success in a lot of arenas as well, having a growth mindset.
And is that genetic, having a growth mindset or not?
I think there's a little, one of the things you learn in genetic research is everything's at least a little genetic. You know, I don't think there's a gene or 10 genes that say code in your brain have a growth mindset, but to the extent it's connected to, you know, things like happiness and optimism, and which are very genetic, it probably does have, at least some genetic component.
Well, that goes into another topic, just as far as genetics and the potential for things. So the role of parenting, you had some really, really interesting findings. How much of their daily choices about how they raise their kids is affecting how their kids turn out in the end?
Yes, there are all these studies on the effects of parenting, and there are different ways to do it. Some studies involve adoption. So I talk about a famous study of Korean adoptees where the kids were essentially randomly assigned to households, and we could really measure, okay, do kids who are randomly assigned to the same household end up similar or not, or do biological kids who were raised in different households end up similar? And there are also studies of twins, as I mentioned, which allow using some math to disentangle nature versus nurture. And I think the major finding from studies on nature versus nurture, there are a couple of big findings in nature versus nurture on parenting. One is that nature matters a lot. So genetics, just really, really important for just about any outcome you could think to measure: happiness, political views, religiosity, income, education. Nature, really, really important. Identical twins who are raised apart, they meet for the first time at the age of 30 and they have all these shocking things in common. Nature really matters. The other thing is that the overall effect of the environment is pretty small. It's not zero, but it's not that much. So, a lot of parents think if I raise my kids right, they're going to for sure be happy. Or if I kid raise my kids right, they're going to be a brain surgeon, or they're going to be the next Bill Gates. And that's clearly not true, and that there's just not that much. You can't move the dial that much as a parent. That said, there is some evidence that maybe one parenting decision that people make may be the most important by a pretty wide margin, and that's where they raise their kids. So there's this data from tax records where they've studied kids from the same families. You kind of control for genetics, who are raised in different areas. So maybe there was a 10-year age gap, and one of the kids had their formative years in Los Angeles and another of the kids had their formative years in Seattle. And it turns out when you look at the data, there are big differences. Certain cities, certain metropolitan areas, certain even blocks within a neighborhood, kids who are raised there turn out to do much better. So why is that? What is it about, an area that leads to successful kids? Many of the predictors of a good neighborhood were surprising to me. There are things like the number of two-parent households in that neighborhood, percent of people who return their census forms, percent of college graduates in that neighborhood. It seems to have a lot to do with the adults in that neighborhood, and basically the adults being good people, good role models. Kids kind of model themselves after the people around, after the people they're exposed to. And if you expose your kids to people who are pretty good at life, you're more likely to have good outcomes. I think parents maybe overestimate the effects they're going to have on their kids and underestimate the effects that other people they're exposing their kids to will have on them, in part because kids rebel against their parents. So kids may think their parents are the coolest people in the world for one period, and then later on they think their kids are the biggest losers in the world. But the other people they see, they're more likely to think, yeah, that person's cool, I want to be like them. So I kind of recommend parents outsource the parenting process a little bit. Expose your kids to people you want them to turn out to be like.
What's interesting about it is that factor of environment is literally, because we're often talking about like genetics versus epigenetics, and epigenetics is the whole thing about environmental influences. So literally this one choice decision is, in a way, environment. Like, and then it makes it even more broad and all-encompassing because, maybe we're saying it's just the neighborhood, but it's not really just the neighborhood, because that would automatically inform, so many other things. Which makes me wonder, because I thought about this a lot when I was reading the parenting book, and I think about it in similar situations in my life, because you talk about how, parents stress so much about all of these decisions that they have to make for their kids, but really, like, it doesn't have that much of an influence in the end. My question is, does the collective whole, though, of all of the decisions have an impact? So, like, maybe this one decision that you make raising your kid doesn't have a huge impact on its own, but if you're applying that mindset of trying to make the best decision for every decision, then does that have an impact?
Yeah. I mean, I think the evidence from the adoptees suggests it doesn't have a huge impact because, you know, presumably some of the parents were much more hands-on and reading every parenting book and doing research on every topic and trying to get every decision right. And some of the parents were more freewheeling and, you know, maybe they read Dr. Spock's book, which suggests that, you know, just follow your intuition. Don't worry so much. You don't need to get every decision right. And it seems the evidence suggests that adoptees exposed to very different parents, adopted parents just don't make that much of a difference. So I think, you know, it's not that parents make no difference. And some parents may say, well, I don't care. Yeah, sure. Even if I'm a great parent, I can only raise my kids' income by 30%, or I can only decrease their risk of depression by 5%. But that's still enough for me to want to do it because, you know, it's the number one thing I care about, how my kids turn out. So even if it has a smaller effect than I might have guessed, I still want to do everything in my power to help my kids. Although one kind of complication with the whole, you know, doing everything in your power to help your kids is because genetics are so important. If you really were doing everything in your power to help your kids, you'd probably get sperm and egg donors because, you know, because think about it, you're unlikely to be the happiest person on the planet, or, you know, have the happiest genetics on the planet or the most intelligent genetics on the planet or the best looking genetics on the planet. So realistically, the best thing you probably could do would be that. But, you know, I think the fact that so many parents don't do that shows that parenting is not all about maximizing your kid's outcome at the expense of everything else. You know, part of what we're doing is sharing who we are with our kids and sharing our particular values and connecting with them and loving them, you know, no matter how they turn out. And, you know, there's more, I think just about any parent, when they think about it, would have to admit that they're not just maximizing their child's, you know, happiness or success or wealth. You know, they're also, you know, doing other things, and I think that's okay.
I guess we'll see how that goes, especially with like the future of gene editing, which, you know, would be kind of like that, I don't want to say a happy medium, but it would be still the, you know, parents, but then, you know, making genetic changes.
Yeah. And, you know, some people say once it starts, there's just going to be no stopping it because, you know, even if, you know, at both the country level and the individual level. So let's say United States says, we're not going to approve gene editing, but then Singapore says, we're going to approve it. Is the United States going to just sit back while Singapore has all these super babies? And then at the individual level, you might say, well, I don't believe in gene editing, but then all your friends are editing their babies and having these, you know, designer babies that are great looking and really, really smart and happy. And, you know, are you going to just say, well, I'm not going to give my kids those same gifts? I don't know. I think I kind of agree that there's something to the idea that once it starts, there's just no stopping it.
Happiness, is that genetic?
Yeah, there definitely is a huge genetic component to happiness and mental health problems, depression, neuroticism, anxiety. You know, it's not as genetic as height or, you know, IQ, but it does have a big genetic component.
So I loved the chapter you had on, was it called the Mappiness Project?
Yeah. The Mappiness Project, yeah.
Yeah. So could you tell listeners a little bit about that project and what they found?
Yeah. So I didn't know about the Mappiness Project before I started researching this book. It's co-founded by two British economists, George McCarran and Susanna Morado. And they ping people at different times. They ping people at different times of the day. And they ask them some basic questions. Who are you with? What are you doing? And how happy are you? You know, 0 to 100. So, you know, you could imagine, you know, if you were participating in this project right now, you'd probably say, I'm by myself and I'm listening to a podcast and I'm 100 happiness because this is so fascinating, or I hope.
You bet it is.
and then later in the day, you'd say, I'm with my romantic partner and, we're eating dinner and I'm a 60 out of 100. And you keep on doing this. 60,000 people did this multiple times to the point they had 3 million happiness points. And they could answer all these really, really interesting questions that obviously everybody cares about, like what activities make people happy, what people make people happy. They could even do things because it was done with iPhones. Even if they didn't ask people, where are you? They knew people's GPS. So they could answer questions like, are there certain environments that make us happy? They didn't ask people, what's the weather outside? But they knew what time it was and where people were. So they could say, what kind of weather makes people happy? So in my opinion, it was a revolutionary project that taught us all kinds of things about happiness. Now, one of the things, the main things that it taught us is the things that make people happy are pretty freaking obvious. Being with a romantic partner, nice days, being in nature, particularly near water, certain activities, socializing, having sex, not rocket science, but I think there's profundity in the obviousness of the data. Because so many of us do these things that don't make us happy, and we don't do these obvious things that do make us happy. So I thought, it's really important to keep in mind how simple some of the things that reliably give people happiness are.
Hi, friends. I have very exciting news. So I know you guys already know and love Element and understand the importance of electrolytes for hydration, energy, focus, supporting your fasting, your workouts, all the things. Guess what? Element has a product that goes beyond electrolytes. What is it? Well, so I am very pro the benefits of caffeine. I love the cognitive benefits, the longevity benefits, and that said, I am a slow caffeine metabolizer, so I don't actually take in lots of caffeine. I've also learned that the form, dose, and balance of caffeine makes a huge difference in how you actually feel. That's why I am so excited that Element has launched a brand new lemonade iced tea. It's refreshing, delicious, lightly caffeinated, perfect for summer, and what I really love is the science behind it. So instead of relying on massive amounts of isolated synthetic caffeine like so many energy drinks out there do, Element Lemonade Iced Tea uses a full black tea extract, so alongside the caffeine, you naturally get compounds like L-theanine and polyphenols. The L-theanine actually helps smooth out the stimulant effect for a calmer, steadier energy experience with less spikes and crashes, while the polyphenols provide antioxidant support as well. And you guys know I am all about the antioxidants. And the incredible team at Element, including my personal hero, Rob Wolf, conducted a meticulous amount of research to find the perfect amount of caffeine, which is the sweet spot for sustained focus and energy without feeling overstimulated or wrecking your sleep later. That is exactly 50 milligrams of caffeine. On top of that, they knew that caffeine can increase your need for critical minerals like sodium, potassium, and magnesium. So that's why Element Lemonade Iced Tea pairs the perfect amount of caffeine with a meaningful dose of electrolytes to support optimal hydration and performance. And of course, Element Lemonade Iced Tea is completely free of sugar, artificial colors, and all the other stuff that you do not want that are so commonly found in caffeinated drinks today. It's built on the same science-backed electrolyte formula that Element is known for, with sodium, potassium, and magnesium in ratios designed to support hydration and energy production. The result? You get your perfect pack of portable, easy-to-make lemonade iced tea that provides steady, clean energy that tastes delicious and actually feels good. As you guys know, Element is trusted by neuroscientists, functional medicine practitioners, professional athletes, including the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, and they're even used by Navy SEALs and the Marines. So are you ready to up your drink level with the ultimate lemonade iced tea? You can get it, and when you get it, get a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase at drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon. That's right, a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase at drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon. Find your favorite flavor or share it with a friend. And by the way, Element has an amazing no questions asked refund policy, so you can try it completely risk-free. If for any reason you're not satisfied, they will give you your money back. Again, go to drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon for a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase, including their new lemonade iced tea. Yeah, I've been asking, because probably a reason I have this show is just because I love learning things and like sharing them with people. I've asked so many people the question of what do they think were the top two things that made people happy. One was sex, right? And then two was going to a show, which made me happy because that's like my favorite thing. So that was fantastic.
People are all over the place. You'd think these things are obvious, like, oh yeah, sex would give the most pleasure, I guess. But, you know, I do the same thing when I give a talk. I say, what's the number one activity? And people say, you know, relaxing, eating. Some people even say watching TV, like lying on the couch. And those activities, you know, tend to be actually below average scoring activities. And I very rarely, you know, very rarely does somebody say gardening, which is one of the top activities, or going to a show doesn't, you know, usually score that high. I think people might not say sex because they're feeling sheepish. Yeah, but you know, there are some systematic biases that we have. I did a study motivated by the Mappiness Project with my friend Spencer Greenberg, where we asked people kind of what you said you did with your friends, but more systematic. We just asked people rank these 40 activities on how happy they make people. And you know, people, there was a correlation. People kind of got that, you know, sex would score higher than doing chores, or that socializing with friends would score higher than waiting on a line, you know, and they're right about that. But there were definitely some activities that people, you know, really thought made people happy that don't make people happy. Conversely, some activities that people thought don't make people happy that do make people really happy. One of the biases seemed to be that people think that lazy activities make people happy and they really don't. So, you know, lying on your couch, watching Netflix, playing computer games, relaxing, you know, all these things, people seem to think that they give people a lot of happiness. When you actually ask people, you know, right in the moment, how happy are you? People who are doing these things tend to say they're pretty unhappy.
Well, I was thinking first for the sleep one, I was thinking that if people are answering that, then it's when they're not asleep.
There are some imperfections in the project, I would say. They do give people time to respond. So if you get beeped, you can say 60, you know, up to 60 minutes later, how were you feeling when you were beeped and what were you doing? So that could explain some of the sleep one. You know, I think even so, you know, do people know how happy they are when they're when they're not fully conscious? You know, I think there were some issues. You know, it wasn't a perfectly designed study, in part because there's no such thing as a perfectly designed study. And a lot of activities were grouped together that I thought maybe shouldn't be grouped together. So
like shopping and errands, two completely different things.
Traveling and commuting.
Oh, those are way different. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a difference between being on the subway at 8 a.m. and being in the Caribbean with your friends by the beach or something. So it wasn't a perfect study, but don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. It still taught us, I think, more than we've ever known about happiness. And I'm sure there have been, I talk about other projects that have been motivated by Mappiness. And so I think people, more and more people are creating these apps. And I think within, you know, 10 years, we're going to know way more about all, you know, what really makes people happy.
I really thought the findings on alcohol and happiness were interesting. What were some of them?
Yeah, that was a study from McCarran and Geiger, and they studied the effects of drinking. And they found that, maybe not surprisingly, drinking does give a boost in mood. But the interesting thing was it only gives a boost in mood for certain activities, and they tend to be the activities that people don't tend to use alcohol for. So drinking gives a boost in mood when you're like doing chores. So you're doing the dishes. You're going to be much happier if you're doing the dishes and have a glass of wine, or you're in the shower. But booze doesn't give a big mood boost when you're doing something exciting, having sex, socializing, you know, being out with friends more generally. Then you don't really get a mood boost. And of course, that's exactly how most people use alcohol. It's like, I'm having so much fun with my friends out at the club, I'm going to drink to make this an even more epic night. And the data suggests that basically doesn't work, that you're going to have fun with your friends with or without alcohol. But, you know, maybe, you know, obviously a huge danger giving this advice, because a lot of people do have problems with alcoholism. And I don't want to encourage people who shouldn't be utilizing this strategy. But I, who tend not to have, you know, either myself or my family have problems with alcoholism, I have occasionally found myself having a glass of wine when I'm doing the dishes based on this mappiness study.
It's so funny. Yeah, I've been sharing that with a lot of people. And I found it interesting. I don't know if it was that study. One of them was talking about next day happiness effect from alcohol. It was counterintuitive.
Yeah, it actually didn't have a big effect. So I would have thought, you know, yeah, you're really happy when you drink, but the next day you pay for it and you feel horrible. And they found that that's not actually the true, that you go back to pretty much where you would have been on average. You know, certainly sometimes, you know, we've all had a horrible hangover, and maybe if you have, may also be a limitation of the study that if you have eight drinks, you're too drunk to answer the mappiness survey. there are all kinds of limitations, you know, with this methodology. But, you know, on balance, you know, I think I took from this study that, with a huge caveat, huge caveat, that alcohol can be dangerous to people with an addictive personality, there definitely is a role for alcohol and perhaps other substances as well in boosting your mood. But we probably use it wrong by, you know, trying to, you know, getting drunk on Saturday night with our friends maybe isn't actually a great mood booster.
Like, I love wine and I have a nightly glass of wine. And out of curiosity, I went a year without any wine because I just felt like, I mean, I'm like a very happy person. That's another question about stats on happiness. You know, they say, I don't even know who they is, but they, you know, they say you're happier without these substances. So I was like, okay, I like won't drink for a year and see if I'm happier. And at the end I was like, I feel happier with my,
with wine. Yeah. My parents, you know, the usual parental advice is always like, stay away from substances. And my parents have told, I think, all three of their kids, you know, me, my sister, and my brother, that we could use substances a little more, because a lot of times we go out to dinner and we're the teetotalers. And, you know, my parents are like, no, you know, have a glass of wine. So I think
all the siblings are.
Yeah. My sister in particular, and she like, you know, almost never has a glass of wine. My parents are always like, come on, have a drink, lighten up, relax. You know, and I think the data says that's not crazy. But of course, you know, there's this huge caveat that, you know, whatever percent of the population, I don't know off the top of my head, does have tendency towards alcoholism, and they have, you know, a glass of wine and they soon have, you know, a whole bottle of vodka.
Just looking though at like the super centenarian studies and like the long lived cultures, they all, except for the Seventh-day Adventists, include alcohol, which I find interesting.
Although there's a recent study that the super centenarians are largely due to clerical errors. Like, they've done studies that when birth certificates became more official, then the rates of centenarians and super centenarians just like dropped precipitously.
I saw some stuff about that.
Yeah. So, and even some of the areas that supposedly produced a lot of people who lived a very long time were areas that just had really bad record keeping. So I think we're going to have to reevaluate some of the analysis of what leads to long life. But I have read some of the same things you've read, you know, the importance of social connection. And so I think it remains to be seen which of these findings survive better record keeping.
One last topic we could touch on. I'm curious. So your job, so success in business. So what you're doing, is that something that normally leads to business success?
Yeah. So in some ways it is. Well, one of the, you know, I talk about the data from tax records. So basically just studies in the last three or four years, they've analyzed de-identified tax records of, you know, the entire top 1%, top 0.1%. And they're really telling us, okay, what it takes to get rich. And, you know, one of the things, you know, there's a sentence in one of the major studies that the typical rich American is the owner of a regional business, such as an auto dealership or beverage distribution company. that really surprised me. I hadn't really thought of, I guess if I thought about, auto dealers, we associate with great wealth, beverage distribution companies, I knew basically nothing about. It's all these basically local monopolies. Basically, you want to own a business that allows for a local monopoly. I recently celebrated my 40th birthday and my dad gave a speech.
Oh, happy late birthday.
Thanks. My dad gave a speech where he just roasted me for exactly what you're saying. He's like, you don't do any of the things you suggest in your book. He started with saying, Seth says that the path to wealth is owning an auto dealership. Seth doesn't own an auto dealership. And, the path to happiness is not watching sports. And Seth watches more sports than anybody I know. And he just went through all the things and explained how I'm not living my advice. But I do think that being an independent creator, which I currently am, actually is not a crazy path to making a lot of money, because you can have a local monopoly through your brand. So if you build a lot of fans, you can make, a good living. You do have to get lucky, which is why I have a whole chapter on how to get luckier according to the data. A lot of people want to be, a successful author, a successful podcaster. But, I think in many ways, it's a better path than being an employee, which the data says is very unlikely. You're very unlikely to make a lot of money as an employee, because the owner of the business kind of is going to take just such a big share of any profit that you produce. So, I guess I am following my advice in that I'm not currently an employee. And I have made, this catches me by surprise, but I was a data scientist at Google, and I've actually probably made 2 to 3 times more as an independent creator on average than I was as a data scientist at Google. Because, as an independent creator, I do get to keep, more of my product than you do as an employee for even a great company like Google.
And why did you leave Google? You shared that story.
I signed this book contract and I just wanted to focus more on my writing. So, and the book contract was paying me more than my Google salary at that time. So I just wanted to give it a shot. I was pretty young. I was like, when I did that, I was about 30, and I'm like, this is my one shot to do something I'm really passionate about and really love. So.
Oh, that's amazing. Wow. You had said something about like Google picking a shade of blue.
Oh, that has nothing to do with me. That was a designer quit the company at Google, quit Google because they, to decide what blue to show their users on their, like on links, they did all these random experiments on, 40 different shades of blue. And the designer was so furious. He's like, this is not art. This is commerce. I'm quitting my job.
Okay. That's so funny. Well, it was motivating speaking to that concept, because I think for a lot of people, especially if they are in a typical 9-to-5 job or a salary job, and I'm not saying, and you talk about this, like there are people who obviously do make a lot of money in those, avenues, but there seems to be a lot of potential for, even more being self-employed.
Yeah, but you got to hustle your ass off.
No kidding. It was interesting to me to read, because going back to like the fan thing, I was like, oh, well, this is like kind of exactly what I am doing. So maybe that's why it's working. Like the, cultivating your own brand so you're not imposed on by other conflicts and competition and things like that. But it was very motivating, because you're saying how like in the media with like self-starters and entrepreneurs, the media makes it seem like it's people like really young that are doing this, but really it's older and like you have like a long time to potentially still make it.
Yeah, there are these studies on successful entrepreneurs, and the average age of a successful entrepreneur is about 45, even in tech, which everyone thinks that you have to be really, really young to be a successful tech entrepreneur, and it's just not true. And yeah, I think a lot of people find that encouraging, that a 60-year-old entrepreneur has 3 times higher success rate than a 30-year-old entrepreneur. And most people don't think of a 60-year-old entrepreneur. So I think that is in part.
Like somebody starting at 60 or somebody who?
Yeah, someone starting a business at 60, yeah.
Wow, that is really motivating.
Yeah, so that's motivating for just about everybody, I guess, except for people in their 80s.
Do you know if there's a sex there? Like, is that just men?
They didn't break it down by gender, no. Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Well, a unifying question that kind of brings everything together is applying this data personally. So like for me, like when I read the happiness chapter and it was saying that people are happy like in warm weather and not cold, like I love cold and I don't like warm. And so there's some things, and that's just a very specific example, but there are some things where it's just not me, for example. So in those situations, if the data just literally doesn't apply, it's just not what I like, does it still apply a little, or do you have to throw out stuff that just for whatever reason doesn't apply to you?
Definitely there's individual variation in everything, and including what makes us happy. And I think as more of these projects like Mappiness are created, maybe the next level is to explore more of the individual variation. That said, I think there is a danger in thinking that you're so unique. One of my favorite studies is they've compared introverts and self-described introverts and extroverts, the mood boost they get from being around other people. And the mood boost is exactly the same. Introverts get just as big a mood boost as extroverts do. Even though if you asked introverts, they say that they predict they would get a lower mood boost because they think, you know, they like solitude, they crave solitude. So that shows that there can be some danger in thinking, you know, yeah, well, everybody else likes gardening, but I like watching Netflix, or, you know, everybody else likes hanging out with their friends, but I like being by myself, or, you know, even everybody else likes 80 degrees and sunny, but I like seasons. You know, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm sure there are some people who, you know, do like more the cold, do like seasons, but we do have to be careful, I think, thinking we're unique in these arenas. Probably, you know, and I think anybody would be wise to at least try the things that make the average person happy, give them more of a shot, even if we think they wouldn't work for us.
That was a really fascinating thing that you talked about the memory of happiness and how it might actually be having an effect on drug trials with medications because people don't accurately remember.
Exactly. Anytime we're trying to make sense of our happiness, we have to keep in mind that we have terrible memories when it comes to what made us happy. And I talk about these studies of colonoscopies where they ask people during the colonoscopy, they say how much pain they're in. And then after the fact, they say, how much pain were you in? And there's almost no correlation between how much pain they were actually in and how much pain they remember being in. And I think, you know, so all of us yes, that's another reason to kind of distrust our own intuition around what makes us happy, that we have these faulty memories. You know, and you might, you know, I'm not picking on you for the weather thing. I'm sure, you know, I suspect you do have a different reaction to the weather than maybe the average person, but maybe, you know, you remember some glorious winter days, you know, and you forget glorious summer days. I'm not saying that's true, but, you know, we do have to be careful in trying to recognize patterns between, you know, our activities, our environment, and our happiness. We do have to keep in mind we can very easily misremember our prior moods.
I could not agree more. The one thing I always say is that the only thing I know is that I know nothing. And I always mention this on the show, but ever since I read the split brain patient studies where they would show people who had some sort of disconnection between the hemispheres of their brain, show them things that only one part of their brain saw and then ask them why they did things that they did. And the language part of the brain would just make up stories about it. I was like, okay, I know nothing, literally. So well, thank you so much. This has been absolutely incredible. The last question that I ask every single guest on this show, and it's just because I realize more and more each day how important mindset is, and it actually relates to something that was found in the happiness data about the present moment. What is something that you're grateful for?
It's hard to pick one because I'm grateful for so many things, but certainly my family, even though I claim that in the book that parents don't matter that much. I definitely feel gratitude towards the parents I have and the siblings I have and the cousins I have. Just have a very warm, loving, nurturing, supportive, non-judgmental family. And I feel very, very lucky because a lot of people do not have that.
I love that so much. I literally, when I read your acknowledgments, because I remember when I wrote my acknowledgments for my book, it was a very similar vibe. I feel like you and I are grateful for very similar things in that regard. Well, thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed your work. I've been just telling everybody about it. Do you have another book coming out?
Not in the near future, but I probably will write another book at some point.
Well, I will eagerly look forward to it. How can people best follow your work?
I'm on Twitter, SethS_D. That might be the best way.
Okay, awesome. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes. Thank you again so much and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks, Melanie.
Thanks, Seth. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information, you can check out my book, What When Wine, Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo-Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine, as well as my blog, melanieavalon.com. Feel free to contact me at podcast@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.